The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, for the reflections for tonight, I wanted to speak about one of the aspects of the Eightfold Path, which is the teachings of the Buddha for liberation. One of the aspects which is not talked about so much, yet we spend most of our lives engaging in it. Wise livelihood. So tonight I want to talk about the aspect of wise livelihood, what Buddha teaches about the wise livelihood, and also our exploration about what livelihood means to us. What is wise livelihood? What is unwise livelihood? So I think it was yesterday. Gosh, today's Monday. Yesterday, Sunday, I spent all day at Spirit Rock teaching a day long on this topic. So exploring an entire day with a group of people on wise livelihood, which is a lot of fun. So it's going to be condensed to less than 45 minutes for our exploration. So what is the idea? So what is the contemplation? So also I want to invite you, if you are retired also, I'd like you to consider this aspect of wise livelihood as how you show up in the world. How do you relate to other people? How do you do your volunteer work? Or if you have hobbies or passions, how do you show up for those? So it can be relevant in so many ways. So the idea of wise livelihood, our practice, we think of our practice, sometimes we have a very limited definition of what practice and meditation is. Sometimes we consider, okay, sitting on the cushion, eyes closed, that's my practice. But actually our practice does not end at the edge of our cushion. Our workplace can serve as our temple for practice, where the proverbial rubber meets the road. You know, otherwise, why are we doing this practice? Why are we doing this thing? Why are we doing this meditations? It needs to infuse our entire life. It would be kind of silly if you sat on the cushion and meditated and you were mindful and you were cultivating metta, loving kindness, may I be happy, may you be happy, and then, okay, you get off the cushion and you get in your car and you're mean and you go to work and you're not. It doesn't quite gel, right? That's not the idea, of course. So I'm making a caricature out of it, so that we actually consider how can we be more intentional about our work and really consider the work that we do, our livelihood in the world, as our practice, as a way that we grow fully as a human being and wake up, really wake up, become free, liberated in the midst of the messiness. And work is not clean. It's not easy. There are always complicated relationships and things that arise and happen. So also to say that, you know, this exploration of our livelihood and work can be a tender exploration. And yesterday, as I was teaching the day long, it was quite apparent that it can be very tender. We even if we don't think about it that way, because we spend so much time, so much of our efforts, our waking life, working. We give our most precious asset to the world through our work, through the expression of our work. Our most precious asset is our time. And we spend, you know, if you work in, 40-hour day, 9 to 5, or maybe sometimes even, this is Silicon Valley, people work a lot more than 40 hours per week, yes? So it's really it becomes an expression of who we are. So we need to be wise about it. So also another thing I want to say is spiritual practice is often more about questions than answers. It's more about searching than finding. It's more about questioning, keep wondering in a wise way. So tonight, my intention is to bring up questions, bring up reflections for you, to ask yourself, to ponder, to reflect about your life, about your livelihood. Not so much provide answers. Ta-ta, you must do this, you must not do that. So do we have an agreement with that? More questions than answers? We're cool? Yeah? Okay, great. So I can proceed now. So having said that, I do want to offer some definitions first. Some definitions from the Dharma. So one is and think of these definitions as the different bars. They're different, like the higher bar, lower bar. Okay, so they're different bars. Definitions of wise livelihood or also translated as right livelihood. So I would say that the lowest bar is also a teaching that many of you might have heard before in the Buddhist setting, is that there are five types of businesses that are not right livelihood. So as long as you don't engage in those five, it's right livelihood. Okay, so what are those five? And this is from Vanija Sutta. So those five businesses are business in weapons, business in humans, in human beings, so human trafficking and selling and buying, business in meat, business in intoxicants, and business in poisons. Okay, so as long as your business does not entail any of those five, then one definition is that's wise livelihood. Okay, that's pretty straightforward, pretty low bar in a way, but really in a way to think about that is that these five kind of align with the five precepts of non-harming. So as long as you're not in a business that's directly trafficking human beings and killing animals and meat and poisons and intoxicants, weapons, you know, it's, you are not breaking the precepts, okay? And come to think of it, you know, 2700 years ago when the Buddha was teaching, there was a lot less flexibility in the world. So if you were born into a family that were farmers, you would probably be a farmer. If you were in the profession of a tanning business, you would be a tanner. So I can see why, you know, thinking about the historical context, setting the bar kind of low would make sense. Otherwise, you say, okay, your work needs to fulfill your intention and your values, you know. We do have the luxury to aim a little higher now if we want to. But just to set that is the bar. That is the bar. So as long as one does not engage in any of those, it is still wise livelihood. Okay, so that's one definition. But now let's move further. So another definition I want to share, not a definition so much, this is from a book called The Buddha's Teaching on Prosperity for lay people. So The Buddha's Teachings on Prosperity, and this book is by Bhikkhu Basnagoda Rahula. And in that, he quotes from the scripture in the Numerical Discourses that's translated as, the lay person's objective is to live a long and dignified life with wealth obtained through rightful means. I'll read it again. The layperson's objective is to live a long and dignified life with the wealth obtained through rightful means. So there are different aspects of this that I appreciate and I want to highlight. One is, as lay people, you know, mendicants, you know, many of the teachings were given to monks who are mendicants, and all they have is just their bowl and their robes and their roof over their head, and they can't even save food from one day to the next. They're not allowed to handle money, monks in this tradition. They're not allowed to own anything, etc. However, the teachings for lay people, which is us, is different. And here there's the idea of living a long and dignified life. So the aspect of dignity, dignified life, with wealth obtained. Oh, wealth. Oh, money's okay. Of course money's okay. There's nothing, you know, in spiritual circles, sometimes there's this feeling, unsaid feeling, oh, money's dirty. There's something wrong with money. There's nothing wrong with money if it's handled well, right? It's just that we often get into trouble with money, with greed and various things. But money in of itself can actually be an expression of our values if we spend it when it's aligned with our values. Then it can be empowered with our intentionality. It becomes even more powerful. Another aspect that this quote talks about is rightful means. So in some way, again, any work that does not violate the precepts can be thought of as a rightful means. So breaking that down even further, think, you know, any work that allows you to earn money to take care of yourself with dignity and take care of the people that you care about, your family, in that way, it becomes wise livelihood by that definition. You're with me so far? Okay. Another definition I'd like to share is from Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen teacher. And he says, to practice right livelihood, you have to find a way to earn your living without transgressing your ideals of love and compassion. The way you support yourself can be an expression of your deepest self, or it can be a source of suffering for you and others. Another one from him. Our vocation can nourish our understanding and compassion or erode them. We should be awake to the consequences, far and near, of the way we earn our living. So now the bar is being set a little higher, right? Now we have our values being brought into the equation, and any work that does not violate, does not transgress ideals of love and compassion. So now the bar is being set a little higher. So bringing that into reflection, is the work that you're doing or you choose to do aligned with the ideals of love and compassion? And does it erode them or does it support them? Here's another definition from S.N. Goenka. If the intention is to play a useful role in society in order to support oneself and to help others, then the work one does is right livelihood. So again, supporting oneself, helping others. So now we have the idea of supporting oneself and helping others. Okay. Now I'm going to start setting the bar higher and higher. Okay. So the next definition I want to explore is actually one that's inspired by Marty Bedeau, founder of Right Livelihoods. And this is an interesting expression because in this she actually brings in all the other steps of the Eightfold Path to help define right livelihood. Okay, so for those who may not be familiar with the Eightfold, who's not familiar with the Eightfold Path so much, so I know how much detail to go into. Okay, great, thank you for your courage, great. So the Eightfold Path are the eight steps of the eight aspects of teachings that the Buddha shared for the process of liberation. So these eight things are what we undertake in our life. And wise livelihood, right livelihood is one of them, and there are seven others. So now I will explain how wise livelihood could be expressed through the other seven, and you can see the relationship. So the first one of the Eightfold Path aspect is considered to be wise perspective or right view, which is also translated as helpful perspective or a wise way of seeing things. And usually in the traditional teachings, that is thought of having a view that has a view of wisdom and compassion, has a view of non-clinging, and has a view of the Four Noble Truths, that, oh yes, there is difficulty in life. There are aspects of life that have what's called dukkha in it, or rub, or stress, and there is a way, there are practices to actually, it's kind of the definition of the right view can be a little circular with the Eightfold Path, and there are practices, which is the Eightfold Path, that can help reduce suffering or dukkha. So with wise livelihood, the right view or the wise perspective involves love and devotion through work. So the wise perspective becomes bringing love, bringing devotion, bringing a perspective of non-attachment to your work. The second step of the Eightfold Path, right intention, from the view of wise livelihood, becomes consciously choosing work that is best for best of ourselves, and having knowledge of our values. So the right intention really becomes an inquiry of our values. Who are we? What is important to us in the world? How do we want to show up? What is the legacy that we want to leave, having lived in this world, in these bodies, and having spent our lives doing something? What is our intention? What are our values? How can we live our values through our work? So right intention gets expressed in this way through our values in wise livelihood. You're with me so far? Yes? Okay. So the third aspect, the third step of the Eightfold Path, right speech or wise speech, which is basically speech that is non-harming speech, is truthful, is timely, it's beneficial, it's kind, not harsh. So right speech in this context implies compassion and integrity, and also having this wise speech, relating to others through our speech in a kind, wise way. And actually, I would highlight right speech as one of the most important aspects of being in the world and working in the world. Because who does not speak at work, right? Or interact with your partners or colleagues? Just by definition, working with other people, you have to interact with them, either through your speech, either through your writing, either through your emails, right? There is that aspect of communication. As human beings, we communicate with each other. So if we only take one, if we leave everything behind and just choose one practice from tonight to take to your workplace with you, I think it would be wise speech. How can you bring aspects of compassion, care, non-reactivity to the way that you interact with other people? Another aspect of that is listening. Actually, the practice of what I like to call whole body listening. So a lot of times when we listen to people, first of all, we're in our head, we're thinking about something else, we've completely tuned out. They're saying something and we're thinking about something else. Anyone yes, everybody's laughing. Yeah, we all do that. We're all guilty of that. So giving other people our attention, our full attention, is really the biggest gift we can give them, whether it's at the workplace or at home or anywhere else. So one practice that I like to teach and invite people to experiment with, which is actually pretty easy, is whole body listening. And we actually do that quite a bit on Wednesdays when there's a program we have here at IMC called Happy Hour, which is practicing Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, metta every Wednesday. And we have interactive exercises where folks are encouraged to interact and speak and listen with their whole bodies. Okay, so what does that mean? Let's try it on for size. Okay, first step, as you're listening to me right now, can you feel somewhere else in your body, somewhere in your body? So for some people, it's their hands. You can feel your hands while you're listening to me, or your feet, or your bottom on the floor, or the cushion, your sit bones, maybe your belly as your breath comes in and out. Okay, everybody got something you can feel while you can listen to me and still hear me out? You can be embodied in somewhere in your body? Yes? Easy? Is it easy? Pretty straightforward, I think. No? Continue to feel something and listen to me, so that your mindfulness, your awareness, is both internal and external. So it seems like riding a bicycle at first, like, whoa, what is she talking about? And then when it becomes a practice, then you can become embodied and not just feel one part of your body, but really be embodied, feel your body, be present, like a rock, be completely present and still listen to another person. So now, let's just try it on for size. May not work, but what if you're listening to with your whole body? What does that even mean? Doesn't matter. Don't try to figure it out. Just try it. Try to listen with your whole body as I'm speaking, receiving, as if your whole body was an organ, was the ear organ. Yeah. Interesting, you know, actually the way you're sitting will change for some people, just the way you're receiving. You have a taste of it, what it might be to actually listen with your whole body, listening. So this aspect of listening and really being present when you are interacting with other people, whether at work or at home, it can be an amazing, amazing asset. The biggest gift of your presence that you can be giving to others. So moving along to the next step of the Eightfold Path, wise action or right action in this context, in the context of wise livelihood, implies doing your work and having no attachment to outcome. What? Having no attachment to outcome? Did she just say that? Yes, having no attachment to outcome. Okay, what does that mean even? Okay. So that comes from the wise understanding. That comes from number one, which relates to wise action. So the idea here is, yes, of course, as human beings, we have responsibility. We have responsibility for the choices we make, for the actions we do. However, we also acknowledge all the causes and conditions that make something happen. so many causes and conditions that make something happen or not happen. We often think it's our response. It's on our shoulders. It's up to us. But it's actually so many different causes and conditions that make something happen or not. So the idea here is you will do your best. You're asked to do your best, aligned with your intention, aligned with your highest intention, doing the best you can, and knowing that even when you do the best you can, there are so many things, so many causes and conditions that this thing may not work. So not being attached to the outcome. Doing your best, but not clinging to the outcome. And one way I like to share a physical way of relating to that is, and I've learned this from Gil. So if I was attached to the outcome, if I was clinging, if I was like, oh, I really like this is like, oh, like, ouch, can you feel how I'm squeezing this striker? It's almost painful, right? Whereas, I can still do my best, but hold it with an open hand. There's just much more freedom. So non-attachment to outcome. And that frees our heart, frees us to do the best work we possibly can, but not get entangled, not really get entangled, and caught up. So the next step of the Eightfold Path is usually wise livelihood, which we've moved to the top. So the next one would be wise effort or right effort. And this one, one could think of it as choosing a work that you can do your whole life and keeping yourself in a state of constant learning and beginner's mind so that you continue to grow and learn. Don't be an expert. Don't be an expert. Have a beginner's mind. Continue to learn. Continue to allow yourself to make mistakes. The seventh step is right mindfulness or wise mindfulness. And in this context, we can interpret it as consciously choosing your path and your work. So the mindfulness, the clarity, the knowing, you know, the being conscious about the choices you make about your path instead of just doing anything. Again, I also want to acknowledge that the other bars of definition of many times we may not have the choice in order to take care of ourselves and our family. It may not be so much too much of a conscious choice. And so again, just offering these for your reflection. The last one, right concentration or wise concentration, means doing the work with care and intense awareness and love, or rather with wholeheartedness. This doing whatever you do wholeheartedly feels very different than doing it half-heartedly. And actually, just experiment right now as you're listening here, as you're sitting and listening. For a moment, I'm going to invite you to listen half-heartedly. See what that feels like. If you're kind of listening half-heartedly, you start to think about something else. You kind of maybe it even shows up in your body language. How does that feel? It doesn't feel very good usually. Just kind of be half-hearted, like half here, half not. Okay, now I'm going to invite you. All right, now listen wholeheartedly. Really bring all of yourself into this room. In this context of sitting here, really listening to every word and reflecting what it means for you. Sense of wholeheartedness, presence. Can you feel a bit of a difference in your body? What it feels like? The half-hearted stance and the wholehearted stance? Please experiment with this. Please experiment with this so that you have it in your body. You know what it feels like when you're wholehearted. when you're completely engaged, when you're really listening, engaging, and when you're kind of like, oh, I'm not so sure. Life is too short not to be wholehearted about what you do. Really, it's just a waste of time. It's a waste of life. It's a waste of perfectly good moments of being alive when you're not wholehearted in what you do. So please be wholehearted in whatever you choose to do. To share a couple of other definitions. This one is from Robin Shearer, founder of Career Enterprises Incorporated, where work and heart meet. And they characterize right livelihood as a sense of ease in work and life, where one isn't caught in an internal conflict. Because when people are at peace about it, it frees energies to be more concentrated, more productive, more focused, and happiest. And the last thing I wanted to share in terms of definitions, oh yes, here we go. This is kind of, it sets, so this is the ideal. Peter LeBrun holds right livelihood as an ideal. Now this is the ideal definition. Living in totally authentic way, with no separation between work life and personal life, going after what you're most passionate about. It is also embedded in the idea of vocational wholeness. To move towards the ideal is the work of a lifetime. So moving towards that throughout the lifetime, when there is no separation between work life and personal life. So I'd like to share a koan, actually. This is relevant. This is another direction that I'd like to share about this talk about. So how do we take, you know, aside from definition of wise livelihood, how do we practice at work? How do we consider work to be the sacred temple where we offer our best? So I've already talked about these different aspects about wise speech, right speech, listening, compassion, kindness, and I'll talk more about compassion in a moment. But another thing I wanted to bring in is this koan. So a monk asked his teacher, what is the Buddha? And the teacher answered, the cypress tree in the garden. It's a koan. It's supposed to be a little, so sit with that a little bit. What could that possibly mean? And what does the cypress tree have to do with the Buddha or the awakened self? So let's imagine the cypress tree spreading over the path of the monastery garden. What could be more ordinary or familiar to the monk than the cypress tree? The monk passes the cypress tree every day. Walks around it, sits by it, sweeps by the cypress tree. It's the most ordinary thing in the yard, in the garden. So it's the most familiar thing. What is the most familiar thing that you pass in your life? Is it your kitchen table, your car, your spouse, your friends, your colleagues? Is it the copy machine in the corner? Is it your computer? Is it your coffee break? Is it your commute to work? Is it your lunch hour? Is it the afternoon meetings that you dread? So the idea here is about a shift in perspective to see the most familiar thing as the way to express the awakened self, the Buddha within, not to take it for granted of the same old, same old, same old, but really a shift in perspective to see the most familiar thing, the most ordinary that you pass by every day, you do every day, what kind of gifts it contains for you if you just received it, You just opened up to it. Another aspect I'd like to touch on is challenges at work. It's quite common to have challenging people we have challenges with at work. So in that way, work can be a crucible for practice where egos clash, buttons are pushed, etc., etc. So there is, I mean, in some ways, these difficulties at work can be fodder for more growth, to open our hearts to compassion, both for ourselves, if we're in a difficult situation, and for others, to see the humanity of the person you're having difficulty with. So one of the practices that actually we did yesterday, and if you come to happy hour, we do this practice, is doing compassion practice or loving kindness practice for ourselves, as well as people whom we're having difficulty with. We usually don't call them difficult people because they're not difficult as far as they're concerned. They're perfectly normal as far as they're concerned. And in fact, they consider you their difficult person. You're their difficult person, right? So it's a practice of expanding our heart in compassion and care to see their humanity, to wish them well, to see their humanity, not to condone the actions. The actions can be hurtful, the actions can be unwise, and we can have fierce compassion and say, no, this cannot happen. However, separate the actions from the human being, from the person, because just like you, the person that you're having difficulty with, just like you, they want to be happy. Just like you, they don't want to suffer. Just like you, they're the object of affection of other people. They're people who love them. They think they're great. Just like you, this person cares about other people. Just like you, they have hopes and dreams. Just like you, they've had disappointments. They've had failure. They've had physical pain. They've had illness. They've had loss. They've cried. They're a human being just like you. They're not different from you at all. The ways you express yourselves in the world is different, and that's the action. But in terms of humanity, you're not so different. So opening your heart to see their humanity and wishing them well, just as you want to be happy, just as you don't want to suffer, may they not suffer. May they be happy and fulfilled. And not condoning the actions. So what this invites you to do, especially in difficult situations at work, is not to be in a reactive place, because when you're in a reactive place and you're hating the person, like, oh, they're just bad, they're evil, they're awful, you're not going to go anywhere. And in fact, who's hurting the most? You are, because you're in that constrained, difficult space of enmity and ill will and anger hurts you more than anybody else. Anger is likened to picking up a hot coal to throw at someone else. Guess who burns when you lift up a hot coal? You burn first before throwing it. So through the practice of loving kindness, metta, compassion, opening your heart to see the other person's humanity, which allows freedom in your own heart, ease in your own heart, to then be able to deal with the difficult situation, with the stressful situation. And having said that, just to say that there are also some difficult work situations that could be emotionally toxic, and they might be more draining you more than nourishing you. So there's opportunities for growth, working with challenges, growing through them, and the point sometimes might come that it's really not nourishing or supportive. And the last thing I want to share is there are many other ways to take your practice to work on. And you're probably doing that already. You might be taking pauses throughout the day, mindful pauses. Another thing to consider is, I actually appreciate this book that I recommend called Deep Work by Cal Newport. And what he espouses is avoiding interruptions. So having a period of time that you're not doing context switching, you're not interrupted, so that you can do deep work, deep creative work. And I think you'll probably see that the effects of interruptions usually show up in your body, in your mind, in your heart, both in your life and also when you sit on the cushion, kind of feel distracted, you feel all over the place. So reducing social media interactions could be a huge way to reduce the context switching. So with that, I'd like to thank you all for coming here tonight to IMC to practice, both in sitting silently, in listening wholeheartedly, practicing with that, and I wish you all both a wonderful evening and wise livelihood, however it might show up for you. May all beings be well, may all beings be happy.